I thought that this message, when I first started working on it, was going to be a simple one, and it got more complex until about 2 o'clock this morning. And it was more the order of the things that I wanted to say. I think what I want to do is just start by telling you a story. And some of you might have heard this story before, but bear with me. I need some new jokes, I guess, huh? You know, in another life, way back when, in the early 80s, when I was in my mid-20s or so, I was working with a group called Children of the Americas that I'm still working with now. But I was in such a life turmoil at that point in my life. I didn't know which way to go. I was working, trying to become a songwriter and a musician, and I was working in the mission field, and I was going to school for an English degree. I mean, I was the picture of the rudderless 20-something, just trying to figure out where to go. And I loved working in Mexico. I loved working for Children's Issues. And a friend of mine who was about as opposite from me as you could get, he was a British national. His name was Bruce. And he had gone to school in this country for international management. He had gone to work for Save the Children. He was now down in Ciudad Obregón, a city on the mainland, on the Sea of Cortez, about 300 miles south of the Arizona border, working with children down there. And he invited me to come down and work with them for several weeks and just see what it was that he was doing. And so I flew down right into the middle of the Sonoran Desert, and I met Bruce, and he started showing me around, and it was amazing to watch him work. Because here he was, a British national who had been out of his own country for about 8 years, and here he was speaking fluent Spanish and working with these people and just blending in to the culture as much as a blue-eyed, blonde, white guy could do, you know. But it was amazing to see him do that. And I remember thinking, I wanted to do that so badly. You know, I wanted to do what he was doing. And he took us out to this remote little school out in the middle of the Sonoran Desert. I mean, really out there. And this school was dealing with Guatemalan refugees. In the early 80s, Guatemala was about halfway through its 36-year-long civil war. And in 1980, it had heated up again, and refugees were pouring over the border into Mexico. And a lot of these boys were ending up at this school out in the middle of the desert. And this school cared for them, tried to teach them and fed them, and was just trying to keep them going as long as they could through the difficulty. You know, most of them had been orphaned because of the war. And so here I am in the midst of all this, from Southern California into this alien environment. And I'm trying to figure out if I belong, where I belong, what I can do. And the afternoon that we were there, they had to gather firewood because that was their only fuel. So they had a stake truck, which is a big flatbed. Probably, I don't know how big the bed was. It seemed huge, you know, 15 or 20 feet long by, you know, 10 or 15 feet wide. And they built sides of the stake. It was at least 10 feet tall. So we're all standing in the truck around the edge, trying to hold on to nothing, basically, as we're bouncing around. And they took us out into the desert. It seemed like forever. It was probably at least a half an hour out into the desert. And our task was simply to go and forage and pick up dead and dry wood and throw it in the stake truck. And so we did that for several hours, just running around, getting wood, throwing it in. And when the whole truck was filled up to the top, then we had to climb on and actually ride the wood back into the school. And wouldn't you know, it's getting dark at this point and it starts to rain. And, of course, me being the guest guy, I was invited to ride up in the cab. And Bruce was smart enough to take that offer. But there was a little boy, and I still remember his name. It was Marcelino. He was probably maybe 8 years old, and I can still see his face. And he kind of caught my eye, and I caught his. And we were kind of doing that little song and dance, cat and mouse thing all the time that we were gathering the wood. And when it time to go back, he called up to me, you know, siente, siente, aquí, aquí, aquí. He wanted me to sit next to him on the wood. So I demurred on the cab, the nice warm cab, and sat next to Marcelino. And we bounced back in the rain and in the dark on that, just sort of trackless desert, it looked like to us, at least to me, all the way back to the school. Unloaded the wood and had beans and something indescribable for dinner that night. And it's just indelibly printed on my mind, you know, this little boy and what was going on there. And then I got an offer. And the offer from the headmaster of the school was, would I come and live with them and work with them and teach English as a second language? And I said, I don't speak Spanish. He says, you don't need to. We don't want them speaking Spanish, you know? And so it's like, okay, you know, what other excuse can I come up with now? Let me think fast. You know, I was able to put him off and said, you know, I've got a lot of things that I'm going to have to take care of in California. Let me think about it. And, you know, there's something powerful about being wanted. Of course, under the circumstances, the fact that I spoke English and was breathing was probably my best qualifications. You know, have you ever been faced with a decision like that? A really big decision that you feel is going to change the course of your life? And how do you make a decision like that? And why does the decision seem so big and so scary? I've been thinking a lot about these things because there are so many people that I've been talking to lately that are having such difficulty in their lives. And when I think about these big decisions that we make, I realize that their bigness comes, I think, from our viewpoint of our lives as this straight path, this idealized path that goes out into the future, and that God has this plan for us, this one path. And if we can figure out what it is and we can execute it and not take any wrong turns, then our life is matched with God's will. And it'll be blessed, and it'll be all these things, and we'll be happy, you know? And all of the angst and all of the, you know, questioning and indecision will just clear up, and somehow we'll know that we know that we're in the right path and all these things. And it's as if there is this destiny out there, but we've got to help it along. You know, by definition, if it's destiny, you can't mess it up, right? It's destiny. It's fate. It's what's going to happen. And yet we worry all the time about making our destiny happen in our lives. And this is exactly where I was at with all of this that was going on, you know? And then later in life, we obsess over the path not taken if things aren't going well, don't we? What if I had done this? What if I had done that? You know, the Marines wanted me. What if I had actually joined the Marines? Where would I be now? What would that be? You know, if I'd gotten married, if I hadn't gotten married, if I had taken this job, gone to that school. And so we think about all the what ifs, you know, when life isn't exactly to our liking. And it's all based on this idea that there is this thing out there, this ideal, and it's just right there, like right on the tip of our tongues, right on the edge of our vision. And if we could just grab it, just touch it, then everything would be as it's supposed to be and not like it is. You know, and is this really a description of life? You know, when are we ever going to feel content? When are we ever going to be okay with our choices and our circumstances? There was an article that I came across, actually a friend of mine sent it to me in email, and I wanted to read just a portion of it because I think it so describes the human condition. It so describes what we're going through. He writes, if you and I are anything alike, then I know there is a constant hunger in you that longs for something. Just stop and look for a moment and you'll find it. You may be successful, yet still you strive. You may be wealthy, yet still you seek again. You may be loved, yet you still wander. You feel it, don't you? Where does the discontent begin? What do you long for? You may sense this hunger, but most of the time you ignore it. Every day you bury yourself in it. You get the kids out the door, you put your time in at work, you fight with your colleagues, and then you rush home to do the laundry before watching your favorite show. But then you worry about the things that break, the neighbors who gossip, and your loved ones who nag. So you escape to go shopping or to the movies to avoid the squeeze. All the while, you build fantasies for a life of greater success, more fulfilling work, early retirement, nicer cars, and better friends. You may never grow weary of this gnawing feeling, however, because you always have hope. Even if you get fed up with it all, you can always pack up the Airstream and move on, start over again. Yet you are drawn on by thoughts of when everything will be just right. When you have the garden and the grandchildren at your home in the country or can escape to a peaceful spot in the forest. You just know that someday it will all turn out and you will reap the quiet wisdom of your golden years. So you are always preparing for things to get better. But when do you get your ideal home? Oh, but when you do get your ideal home, you soon find things go wrong with it. Or when your perfect semi-retirement situation finally works out, you become bored from the lack of excitement. To fill the void, you drink, you turn to shopping, cleaning, golfing, fishing, gambling, or whatever addictive behavior it takes to fill the nagging sense of emptiness. You are so caught up in preparing and running after things that you forget to live fully. Then you look back on that time nostalgically, even though you were so wrapped up in whatever you were doing that you missed it. For most of us, this endless planning, doing, fixing, and upgrading is what we call life. We have many more glamorous words for it: yearning, questing, searching, craving, striving, seeking, or thirsting to do whatever we are compelled to do. I call it our hungry spirit. It is a pervasive energy that is constantly longing for finding our place in the world. All our worldly concerns are subordinate to it and a means to its end. It helps us find and make meaning, and every act, every word, every thought is a reflection of it in some way. What exactly is this hungry spirit really looking for? Aristotle said it is happiness. It's the meaning and purpose of life, the whole aim and end of human existence. So we occupy ourselves with it more than any other single endeavor in our lives. That's why we buy iPods and iPads and iPhones for convenience, as well as Viagra and breast implants and liposuction for confidence. It's also why we constantly seek new jobs, boyfriends, girlfriends, and experiences like sweat lodges in Sedona and bungee jumping off the Royal Gorge Bridge. The trouble is that we are never, ever satisfied. This incessant searching and doing often feels empty because it is empty. Why? The things we pursue appear real, but they are not real. Like a mirage that vanishes as we approach, the satisfaction of reaching a goal quickly dissolves as we reach it. We become swept up in a mindless pursuit of a rainbow's end. But as Lily Tomlin once said, the problem with the rat race is, even if you win it, you're still a rat. You know, that's it, right? We think that these things that we search for, we think that these things out there that we can pursue are going to change us, but they don't. The more we pursue these things, the more, by virtue of simply engaging in the race, we reinforce our ratness. We reinforce that part of us that engages in such behavior. And we aren't changing from the inside out. We're now becoming defined by the things that we pursue. Those very things that we go after become us. You know, we become the things that we seek. So, what is it there for? What is that hunger there for? What is that thing that pulls us on there for? Is it just a cruel joke? You know, is it just God's way of kind of giving us something to do with our lives because we don't know what we do afterwards? You know, it's so important to understand that this longing is this drive, this call to what is truly important in life. The problem is we don't know what is truly important in life, and it takes a while to try to figure that out. You know, another chapter from my life. I spent my entire 20s and early 30s chasing down a career in songwriting and music. That's what I thought that I wanted to do. You know, in between going to Mexico and doing the other things. By the way, I did not take that job. I realized what I was doing was trying to be Bruce, and I wasn't trying to be myself. And Bruce was truly a citizen of the world, and I wasn't. I had a sense of place. I had a home, and it meant something to me. And doing that was just something that I couldn't handle. But I'll tell you what, I spent a terrible 2 weeks trying to come to that decision. And I spent a terrible several months trying to forgive myself for that decision because I felt like I failed. I felt like I failed Marcelino. I felt like I failed all the people that needed me. And so I threw myself even harder into music. And I can't ever remember in that period of my life enjoying music, just listening to music. And yet I worked hours and hours and hours, sometimes 17 hours at a stretch, writing or recording or doing the things that I did. And it was always out there someplace. If I could just get a song published, if I could just, you know, get this publisher's ear, if I could, you know, connect with this person that would lead to this, that would lead to that, and maybe this next song is the one, you know, that will connect and you know, it was a miserable time. And I didn't even realize how miserable it was. And then the year that Marion and I got married, 84, you're not that old, honey, I'm sorry, 1994, what should have been, you know, finally reaching that goal, I actually sold the song to a publisher, and it was recorded by Ernestine Anderson, who probably none of you have ever heard of, but she is a jazz singer that goes back to the Seattle Sound and Quincy Jones, and she did an album that year called Now and Then, and she cut my song and recorded it. And it was just the most amazing thing. And Styx Hooper from the Jazz Crusaders played drums and was the producer. And Ernie Watts played the saxophone solo. And he was like my saxophone god. And I got to go to the final mixdown session. And I thought, okay, then the album was nominated for a Grammy for Best Jazz Performance of the Year. And it's like, wow. And then she didn't win because Natalie Cole sang that song with her father, Unforgettable, that year. She won! It's like, oh! But it was on a Grammy-nominated album. Ask me what all that means to me now. You know, to add insult to injury, what it cost me to do the demo to sell the song was more than anything I ever got back in royalties for that song. I lost money on the deal. You know? It was one of those mountain peaks that you see in the distance and you go after and you go after, and when you get there, it's just another step, and then you step away and it's gone. And I invested 15 years in that moment. And now music has become something completely different to me. I've stepped away from the longing for it to lead somewhere to a career. And I'll tell you what, when I show up on Sunday morning and we do what we do, I consider myself one of the luckiest guys in the world to be able to play with the musicians that are on this stage here. Wonderful musicians, wonderful people. And I just go away. I immerse myself in the music. I'm actually enjoying music now, and I never did before. I'm not caring about whether it's leading someplace. It just is what it is in this moment, you know? And of course, this is probably the best I've ever played because I'm not worried about where it's leaning. I can just play, and it doesn't matter. And everything has changed about the experience. And I think that, well, let me put it this way. A friend of mine, when I told this story to her, said to me, well, I got to tell you, it sounds to me like you gave up on your dream. And I had to think about that for a while. And did I just give up on my dream? Did I cut it short? You know, it was more like the dream gave up on me. It was more like I realized my place in the pecking order of musicians in the world, you know? And there are people who roll out of bed who can do anything I do better after 15 years of trying. But I realized that there was a place for me in music that was so sweet. And it didn't matter anymore. And I think what happened was that the importance of the dream, the lure, the illusion of what was out there became replaced by so many other things in my life. Things that were here and now and created a sense of meaning and purpose that wasn't out there someplace. It was immediate. It was here. And it just lost whatever it was that was dragging me. I would be the first person to tell you not to give up on your dreams. But we have to realize that if our dreams eclipse our lives, if our dreams are keeping us in that state of angst, in that state of projecting out in the future, then something is wrong. Something is wrong with the way that we're looking at life. And Jesus talks about this really over and over and over again. But as we were doing our Bible study on Wednesday night and we were going through Matthew 6, it just struck me how Jesus is putting his finger right on this spot, right on this place in our human condition, where we stay out there longing for something at the expense of what's happening right now. And I know you didn't get handouts today, but maybe, Greg, you could put this up, Matthew 6, 19 to 21. And Jesus is talking about all sorts of things. He's talking about what righteousness is and about prayer and fasting and giving and all these things. And all of those teachings lead up to right here at Matthew 6, 19, where he says, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in or steal. For where your treasure is, your heart is also." Now, we hear this and we think about behavior. We think that Jesus is trying to modify our behavior. He's trying to get us to be generous and not miserly or stingy. He's trying to get us to think in the spiritual realm instead of the worldly realm. But really, where Jesus is headed here is much deeper than that. Where Jesus is trying to take us is to the place of identity. He's trying to get us to think about who we really are. Who are you? Is it all these things that you pursue? Is it all the roles that you play? What is it? Where your treasure is, your heart is. You want to know who you really are? Look at the things that you pile up in your life. Look at the things that you pursue, the things that you're after, the things that you are always projecting outward for. Whether you like it or not, whether you state it or not, whether you even believe it or not, that's your identity. And he follows it up here at Matthew 6:24. "No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and mammon." And mammon, again, we think of material wealth and finances, but that's not what mammon means. Mammon actually comes from the Canaanite deity of wealth or avarice or greed, Mamona. And literally in the Hebrew mindset, it meant the things that you pile up in your life that come to define you. Sound familiar? Those things that you pile up, whatever it is, what is it that you rely on? What is it that you're going after? Is it physical looks and beauty? Is it talent? Is it a skill? Is it wealth? Is it power? Is it fortune, fame? Is it just respect from your colleagues? What is the thing that drives you, that you rely on when the chips are down? That's your mammon. That's your identity. And in a very real way, that's your God. No matter what else you state, Jesus is trying to get us to see the linkage between that. He's trying to get us to see where our identity lies. And then he follows that up with four illustrations. And at the next verse, 6:25, he says, "For this reason," mark that, "for this reason." If it's therefore, for this reason, because it's referring to something that just happened. What's he talking about? Because your identity is tied up in the things that you long for, the things that you pursue, the things that are your end in themselves as you move through life. "I say to you, do not be worried about your life as to what you will eat or what you will drink, nor for your body as to what you will put on. Is not life worth more than food and the body more than clothing?" What is he trying to do here? Four illustrations, four principles he's trying to get across. And the first one is to keep things in perspective. Remember when he said that the Sabbath was not, man was not made for the Sabbath was made for man? Had to get that one right. Why? Because all perspective had been lost. The Pharisees were so about protecting the law of not working on the Sabbath that they made it such a burden that it was no longer the rest and refreshment and reconnection with their God that it was intended to be from the first point. And so Jesus has to remind us, you weren't made for the Sabbath. The Sabbath was made for you. You weren't made for your clothing or for your food. That was made for you. Keeping things in perspective is this first step towards starting to reassociate your identity. Is a tail wagging the dog in your life? Have things got so out of proportion that you are mindlessly following the path that you set out somewhere in the past and you're missing everything in front of you? Is it upside down? Look at that. Take a look. See what Jesus is pointing to right here. In the next verse, look at the birds of the air. That they do not sow, they do not reap or gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not worth much more than they? What's he talking about here? Is that a license that we don't have to work? Cool. I'm going to be like a bird. I'm just going to flit around and hang out, and Father's going to feed me. Absolutely not. There are so many scriptures. Basically, Paul's saying, if he will not work, does not eat. You know, God's speaking to Adam and Eve in the garden. You know, it's by the sweat of your brow that you will bring forth your sustenance. We are going to work. Now, Jesus uses a very specific analogy here. Look at the birds. Analyze what the birds do. What's a bird's life about? His whole waking existence is about gathering and eating and excreting, huh? That's what they do. But what they don't do is store for the future, do they? Worry about, is there going to be stuff on the ground around Starbucks tomorrow? They don't worry about that. They just show up. And guess what? There is stuff laying on the ground. Are we supposed to live exactly like that? Well, no, we can't. We still have to be responsible. We still have families. We have to have 401ks and insurance policies. But if all of our confidence is put in those instruments, then there's something wrong with our lives. What is Jesus telling us here? Second principle, he's telling us to stay in the present moment. Don't live out there someplace when your T-bills mature. That's not where it's at. Yes, invest well, be responsible, take care of your children and the people that are in your care. But this is where we remain grounded. The worrying part is the part that projects into the future. The worrying is the part that does us no good. Do as much as you can in this moment for the next moment, and when you're done and there's nothing else you can do, stop. What a concept, huh? How many of us actually do that, though? When everything is done that can be done, the mind keeps going, wearing that rut in our brain. For what purpose? For no purpose. The worrying does nothing. And Jesus says in the next, and who of you by being worried can add a single hour to his life? Follows exactly on. What's the principle here? If you can't change the most basic things in life, if you can't add a minute to your life, a hair to your head, an inch to your height, if you can't change the most basic things, then why worry about the rest? There are things we just don't have control over. What is Jesus telling us? Accept your dependence. Accept it. Make friends with it. Revel in it. You know, like Bill Cosby said, I've seen the boss's job and I don't want it. Do we really want that job? Do we want to be in charge of all these things? We aren't anyway. We might as well just accept the fact we are not in control of this ride. And so we allow ourselves to be in the moment, to keep things right-sized and in perspective. And then at Matthew 6:28-30, why are you worried about clothing? Observe how the lilies of the field grow. They do not toil, they do not spin, and yet I say to you that not even Solomon in all his glory clothed himself like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which is alive today and tomorrow is thrown into the furnace, will he not much more clothe you, you of little faith? Think about a plant. A plant can't think. A plant can't act. A plant's a vegetable. It can't do anything. And yet, its beauty is beyond all compare. The beauty doesn't come from what it thinks about. The beauty doesn't come from what it plans or what it does. The beauty comes from what the plant is, from its essence. What Jesus is trying to tell us is learn to recognize true beauty. Not the things that we try to add on, But basically, we need to take all those things away. Our true beauty is rooted in our identity. Our identity is rooted in who we truly are. Not the person that we have taught ourselves to be, allowed ourselves to become, dragged on by the things that we think we need in order to find identity, meaning, and purpose. And in reality, all those things need to be let go, peeled away, stripped down, right to ground zero. That is as beautiful as you will ever be when you are exactly who God made you to be. And anything added to perfection is less than perfection. Jesus is taking us here. Matthew 6:31-34. Do not worry then, saying, what will we eat, or what will we drink, or what will we wear for clothing? For the Gentiles eagerly seek all these things. And by Gentiles, it doesn't mean a non-Jew. That meant anyone who does not know our God, does not know our ways, does not understand our way of life. If they don't know our God, yeah, they seek after all these things, because it's all that they have. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. So do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will take care of itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. And truer words were never spoken there. Jesus is giving us four principles, four illustrations, four ways that will lead us on a path to finding our true identity. An identity that is the only thing that can fill that longing, that desire, that hunger that is dragging us through. Jesus is pointing us to our true selves. A true self that can be content in all circumstances. I know so many people, especially I suppose at the age I'm at, you know, the midlife crisis is securely set in at this age. And I know so many people who are going through that. A midlife crisis is simply a crisis of meaning and purpose. I think it first hits us in our mid-30s, the real midpoint of our lives, generally speaking. But we typically kick the can down the road. So by the mid-40s, it comes back with a more vengeance. And by the mid-50s, now you're getting the red sports cars and the girlfriends. But the crisis of midlife is, who am I? Why am I here? These are the questions that are right at the existential bottom of who we are as people. And we're crying out to God and acting out in all sorts of ways. And so the more that that answer eludes us, the more we do not know who we are, the more we look to all the things in our life as being the perpetrators against us, thinking that if I can change these circumstances, then everything will be all right, right? The usual MO. And of course, a marriage is the first thing to get the brunt of that angst. The path not taken. If I hadn't married this person, if I had done something else, if I had done this, done that, done the other thing. And so we all look at marriages and we're too eager to throw them away because we're looking for something out there still and not seeing what is right here in front of us. I have a friend who's really going through a tough time with her marriage, and she's in the midst of her midlife crisis, and she doesn't know if she can hang on to this relationship. And we've been talking about it, and she has a friend who 5-6 years ago was in the exact same space, and she hadn't seen her for a while, and they reconnected, I think through Facebook, and doesn't everybody? To find out that this woman is not only still married, but they seem to be doing really, really well. And so she wrote to her and she said, what gives? You were ready to walk out all these years ago and everything seems to be going so well. What has changed? And her friend wrote her back and she gave me permission to anonymously read her response. Please listen carefully to what this woman says. She says, I've been giving your question a lot of thought and have come up with a shortened answer because I type too slow to really say absolutely every little bit of what I would like to say. So, I guess I have come to terms with who I am in this life by realizing that I have made choices at the various turns and ended up on this path. Along the way, I have affected folks by marrying, giving birth, befriending them, etc. And I just don't feel that I would be true to myself if I let them down. Committing myself to this situation has made me work harder at making it work. I make myself feel like I'm not going to miss out on anything, which makes it easier to resist the temptation of, I have to try everything now. The question, what is my purpose, would change depending on what stage of life I am in and has changed with the choices I have made. I don't feel like there is some big thing I'm supposed to do, but all the little things that make a difference and make me feel purposeful. My mom always took the time to listen and really tried hard to make people who came to her feel better. She died 8 years ago, and I still hear people who only met her once tell me how much she meant to them and what an inspiration she was to them. She was just a kind-hearted, thoughtful person, and I don't think she felt she had a purpose, but was just doing what seemed like the right thing to do at the time. I think by trying to see the good in my marriage and realizing that by committing myself to making it work for the good of all the lives that are affected by it has in turn made it better. There are still times when I wonder, what the hell was I thinking 32 years ago, and how can I still be here? But then a week later, I'm thinking how lucky I am to have this person who has stuck with me through all my crazy times. He may not fully appreciate who I am, but lets me be me anyway. Or maybe he's just given up and figures he'll get more sex if he's nice. Can you say that in church? I'm sorry. Whatever the motivation, it seems to be working. I don't think you can shoot for perfection in anything involving human beings, and trying to will only lead to frustration. I'm glad you asked these questions, as it has gotten me to thinking about life and family and what is really important. I want to write more, but I keep getting interrupted and I'm going to quit. You know, that last line speaks volumes to me. She thanks her friend for asking her the question, because she hadn't really thought of the answer before. You see, we think we got to get it all figured out. We got to have the clarity. We got to know exactly what we're doing before we go. And all she really needed to do was to jump back into her marriage with both feet. Get off the fence. She didn't need any answer. She didn't need any strategy. She just needed to recommit. And in the recommitting, certain things started to happen and take her away and pull her through. She realized that her purpose wasn't one big thing out there someplace that she had to do and had to find that one true path. But it was all the little things that she consistently did that added up to an identity, an understanding of who she really was, that gave her a direction and a purpose and an ability to repeat the things that she was doing, to be repeatable, to be consistent, to be someone who could be counted on. And not someone that you never knew where they were going to come down on an issue. But she hadn't thought through it. She lived through it. And all those little details started to add up to something. She started to become a person, hopefully, like her mother. Think about that. After one meeting, to leave such an indelible impression on somebody that they remember you years later. To be that kind of person that can and does lead people better than you find them at any given moment. How does that happen? That happens when you let all the details in your life add up to purpose and identity. And it's not out there someplace. If it's out there someplace, you're always looking over a person's shoulder toward that thing. You're not looking them in the eyes. And she let go of the pursuit of perfection. And she learned to enjoy beautiful imperfection. Not some standard in her head, an itch that could never be scratched, an ideal that a living, breathing person could never live up to. But she started to immerse herself in this moment. So, did she sell out? Did she give up on her dream? I suppose that answer to that question depends on what she's really feeling. I don't know that we can say that from the outside. Is she just whistling past the graveyard? Or is she really and truly finding the pleasure in her marriage that eluded her before? Does she hear the music now and get lost in it? Or is he still trying to strive for something else? I wanted to read you just that last portions of Matthew from the Message. And listen to the way that Eugene Peterson translates, paraphrases this. He says, this is Jesus speaking, "What I'm trying to do here is to get you to relax, to not be so preoccupied with getting, so you can respond to God's giving. People who don't know God and the way he works fuss over these things, but you know both God and how he works. Steep your life in God reality, God initiative, God provisions. Don't worry about missing out. You'll find all your everyday human concerns will be met. Give your entire attention to what God is doing right now, and don't get worked up about what may or may not happen tomorrow. God will help you deal with whatever hard things come up when the time comes." See, we look to our treasure, we look to our dreams for happiness, for the path to God's will. But what Jesus is saying here is, the moment you give up your dreams, the moment you give up your treasure as prerequisites to happiness, is the moment your dreams come true. In that very real way, when we realize that our treasure, our identity, is not in the dream out there someplace, that it's in God, our identity is in God, then we get the dream too. Let's pray. Well, Father, as we say so many times, if it were easy, everybody would be doing it. Help us move against the current of our own human nature. Help us to become aware enough in the moment that what we're doing is leading us away from you, away from each other, and away from the only source of provision that we can muster in this life, which is this moment right here, right now. Help us to become grounded in this moment. Help us to really see where our identity lies in you. And redirect our longing, not for the things that divert us from our path, but for just longing for you. Longing for the kind of unity and love and relationship that you are. We want to be that too, so that we can be people who can just be content. And we can make our relationships sing. We thank you, Father, that we can even do this at all, that you have given us that ability to relate to you and to each other. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. Let's all stand.